house is up. Trius is up. With Ray and Cap. Caesar was a vampire. Don't make me pull a Sulla. Life of Caesar.
Sorry.
You think that shit's funny?
I meant to hit the stop recording button so I could start a new recording, but I killed the show. Killed the whole thing. Gotcha. Welcome back, Ray.
Cam, thank you.
How was the holiday, man?
It was fantastic. The weather decided to cooperate, and there was a couple of surfing contests on the beach while we were there. Not that I looked, but... it was just an amazing time, and with family and friends, and just had a great time. And it was very hard to come back, but come back I did.
I remember before you went away, and we were talking about the fact that you were going to a beach, and I was a little bit disparaging about what I thought the quality of U.S. beaches would be. But I saw some of the photos. It looked like a really nice spot.
Yeah.
Nag's Head,
Virginia, North Carolina. Sorry. So but you were like, a beach? That's not a beach.
Chrissy and I actually watched the original Crocodile Dundee film again the other day, and I can tell you, it holds up pretty well, surprisingly, for a movie that's nearly 30 years old.
I considered shaving with a big-ass knife after watching that. It's a good thing I didn't follow through, but the urge was there.
Yeah, you know, he didn't shave with the big-ass knife.
No, either. No, he had a stuntman do that, but the stuntman was an Aussie too, so it's okay.
So let's get into episode 20 of The Life of Caesar. Welcome back, everybody that is listening. Thank you for all of the support and the comments and the emails and the tweets and the Facebook posts and the photos.
All of it.
Yeah, it's been good fun. Congratulations to Amanda for winning the competition the other day. She got a coffee mug that's on its way to her. We'll do some more competitions coming up. So if you're not on our Facebook page yet, folks, and you want to win free shit like coffee mugs or maybe T-shirts or stuff, go to facebook.com/lifeofcaesar and join in the conversation and win prizes. What else? What do you need? What do we need to do convince you?
What do we have to give away? Don't answer that. But Cam and I get bored, and so we just shoot up a question and say, hey, whoever's the first one to answer wins. So not only do you have to like it and watch it, but you have to kind of keep it up on your screen, and because you just never know when we're going to do something. We don't know when we're going to offer up something.
I said on our Facebook group the other day, what do we need to give people to get them to join? Should we send them a naked photo of Ray killing a snake? And a lot of people said, well, what you should do is threaten to send them the photo of Ray naked killing a snake if they don't join Facebook.
Right.
Use it as a threat more than as an inducement.
Ha, ha, ha. So what I did was I took down all the names, I looked at their addresses, and they're all getting bits of snake mailed to them. So
it's not like a horse head in their bed. It's just a
That's the best I could do. Yeah.
So when we finished episode 19, Caesar has come back from his second expedition to the land of tin, Britain. Mm-hmm.
I impress easy.
He is super wealthy dude now, not because of that necessarily, but over the period of time that he's been the proconsul of the Gauls in Illyricum, he is super wealthy. He's also, his fame, his renown in Rome surpasses no bounds. He is what he's always wanted to be, pretty much the most famous and possibly the wealthiest, if not one of the wealthiest men in Rome. But unfortunately, while all this has been going on, his daughter, Julia, wife to Pompey of the Triumvirate, dies in childbirth. And the infant that she was giving birth to, some accounts say it's a boy, some accounts say it's a girl, only survived a couple of days and perished as well. And I don't know, Ray, I think this is probably the turning point of the triumvirate. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, that was the huge linchpin. I mean, it was just an added bonus that Pompey and Julia actually loved each other and spent time together. And he was actually criticized for being away from Rome too much because he was with his wife and one of his estates, just spending time together. I mean, yeah, there was a huge age difference, but they seemed to be truly in love. They spent a lot of time together. He was rumored not to have any women on the side, not to, how should I put this, take advantage of any slave women on his property. And they just spent time together, and his heart is crushed. Caesar's heart is crushed, but the huge link between these two very powerful, egotistical men is severed, and Caesar's got to react to this.
And we don't exactly know how old she was, but I think they assume that she was in sort of her mid-20s when she died.
Yeah,
but yeah, like there's a lot of talk in all of the books that I've been reading about how genuine. I mean, it was a political marriage between Pompey and Julia.
Yeah,
obviously,
it started out that way. Yeah,
but it seems to be genuine, as you say. Pompey was criticized for Remember, he had received his proconsulship of Spain after he and Caesar and Crassus got together and did their little deal. But he hadn't he hadn't gone to manage it personally. He was just I could go and do that, but then I got to leave my wife behind, and she doesn't want me to go. So he was sending pro forma representatives off to basically govern Spain in his stead, so he could stay in Rome and be with the woman that he loved, which is kind of sweet and romantic and surprising in many ways. Right.
Which makes it all the more sad for him and for us in the story. And we have to mention that, as far as we can tell, this was her she had a miscarriage before when she was pregnant. I don't know how many episodes ago it was when the triumvirate were campaigning in Rome, and it got pretty ugly. And one day Pompey comes home covered in blood. Not his blood, somebody else's blood. So somebody actually had a worse day than Pompey did. But supposedly she was pregnant, saw him drenched in blood, thought it was his, was very upset, and lost a child then. But this time, for whatever reason, whatever happened, she does die during childbirth. And the world as we know it is about to change, especially for Caesar.
So there are no surviving grandchildren. Well, would be a child of Pompey.
Legitimate, you know.
The bloodlines are not intermingled.
Just think about a child with both of their blood. I mean, that would, who knows what would happen. But anyway.
But it's not to be. And not only did Julia die in 54, but also Caesar's mother, Aurelia. She would have been in her 60s. We don't really know the cause of her death, and she'd been widowed for 30-odd years. But again, Caesar was very, very close to his mother as well. So he's lost both his mother and his daughter and the wife of his frenemy.
Right.
I think is probably the best way to describe his relationship with Pompey and Crassus. They were all frenemies.
Yeah.
So this does not bode well.
Well, if you think about it, Julia dies, Caesar's heart is broken, and when Aurelia dies, we don't know the true degree of this, but there are sources that say she was a very good sounding board for him, and she gave him a lot of good advice over the years. I'm sure he took some of it, ignored others, but he doesn't have that voice to go to anymore. So now he's got to scramble and come up with something as far as Pompey goes. I think it's interesting, and we've kind of talked about this, but you never know how sincere this is. But during all this time that he's been in Gaul and Britain and whatnot, Cicero and Caesar have been writing letters to each other. Now, for Caesar, it's very important to have Cicero on his side. You don't know to what degree he was on his side, but they're doing a lot of letter writing. And after Julia dies, Cicero writes him a very heartfelt letter of condolence about his daughter. I mean, I think the game of politics was put aside for a moment, and he's just like, I'm so sorry for your loss. But what Cicero doesn't know is in the not too distant future, his own daughter is going to die of a relatively early age, and he'll have to go through that same experience as well.
Yeah, I've read that letter, and I mean, I think it may be genuine, but I think it was also fairly political. I mean, I think Cicero at this stage, you know, is well and truly realized what side of his right. bread is buttered on, and he's taking every opportunity to suck up to both Caesar and Pompey. But yeah, I mean,
you know, yeah,
hard to know. After reading the Pro Marcello speech by Cicero, I'm fairly convinced that he could be a major suck up. And let's recall that when he was exiled and in the time of Clodius, and he's only managed to come back due to the favor of Caesar and Pompey. He's taken every opportunity to strengthen those bonds. But this is no doubt a very tragic moment for all involved. Pompey plans to have her ashes interred in a tomb at one of his estates near Rome. But apparently, we don't know whether or not this was planned or it was just made to look spontaneous. There was a huge crowd of onlookers after her funeral that said, no, no, we're going to take her remains to the Campus Martius, which was created a bit of a stir in some camps, because the Campus Martius traditionally had been used as a fairly special area for training the army, and it was dedicated to the Latin god of war, Mars, and had an ancient altar that was supposedly something to do with the god of war and the soldiers. It was all secret, secret, hush, hush, men's business. And they had had sort of camp triumphs there. So she was not a soldier, obviously. And to bury her in the Campus Martius, it was shocking. And a lot of people said this was inappropriate. This should not be done. But of course, Pompey was a great soldier. Caesar was a great soldier. And for whatever reason, she was buried there.
And they put up a monument to her that lasted for centuries. It's gone now, but there was, again, you never know what's real and what's staged, but there seemed to be some genuine outpouring of sympathy or love for this woman who was you know, connected to two very powerful men. And Caesar was going to throw games for her. It's just that at the moment he's a little bit busy, and I don't think his games for her to come for another 10 years or so. Yeah, he's got his hands full.
Yeah, not until he's dictator, I think, does that actually happen.
Right. Yeah. So, what did you think of Caesar's idea to rebind himself and Pompey?
Yeah, so he starts looking for another politically convenient person that he can marry Pompey to. He's looking at his great niece Octavia, and he says, "You're like, oh, you marry Octavia, I'll marry your daughter Pompeia." Which would have required Caesar, Octavia, and Pompeia to all divorce their current spouses and remarry. Pompeia was currently married to Sulla's son, Faustus.
Yeah.
But Pompey's like, maybe it was partly he was still in mourning.
Sure.
For his wife, and maybe it was also like, it's one and done, dude. One and done. We had a crack at this. It didn't work out. I don't want to bind myself to you too closely. What do you think? Right. Do you think his rejection of the remarriage was based on his affection for Julia, or for political reasons, or both?
I think it was both. I think half of his heart was genuinely missing that part of his life, and the other part, because these guys are the center of their world. They're senators. They're very powerful. They can't just make decisions for selfish reasons, because it affects this city and the republic around them. So I'm sitting there thinking, he's going, one, no, I still miss Julia, and two, she's not august enough for me. So thank you. No, thank you. Let's see what happens. But there were still advantages to the triumvirate. So there's not a complete break, but Caesar's got to know that the absolute hold he had on Pompey is no longer there.
So now I guess we move on and talk about the third triumvir, Mr. Crassus.
Yes.
So while all this has been going on,
he's got plans.
He does.
Crassus has got plans.
Crassus is such a fascinating character. And just to recap, if people sort of forget a little bit about who Crassus is, yes, he's one of the triumvirs, but from the very beginning of the series, almost, we've been talking about Crassus as one of the wealthiest men in Rome. Mm-hmm. He not only probably loaned a lot of money to Caesar during the course of his career, but he probably had many, many, many politicians that he loaned money to in order to further their careers. So he could, call in favors.
Absolutely.
Regardless
regardless
of who was consul at any given time, mm-hmm. they probably owed Crassus at some stage.
Yeah, the one step of their on their way to the top was probably due to him. So he had mm-hmm. access. But, you know, I mean, you got to remember, he did do a big part in stopping the slave revolt, Spartacus. But between Pompey doing what he did in the East and the pirates and what Caesar's doing in Gaul, even though Crassus is a solid military leader, his military reputation, if you will, is certainly being dimmed by these other two. So when they were consuls, they had their own 5-year commands put together, you know, and what Crassus, and he's always had Egypt on his mind. So he gets his province, and he wanted to go into Egypt, but there had just been a war there, so things were kind of calm. So what Crassus decides to do is kind of do what Caesar did. He's going to go invade Parthia. He's got absolutely no excuse, no reason to do this. It's going to piss off a lot of people, but Crassus is going to go, and he's going to invade, and he's going to reclaim the military glory that he, for a moment, had after defeating Spartacus. So he's got a plan. We'll just have to see what happens.
Because we have to remember that in this era, your glory was only as old as the last thing that you did, only as good as the last thing you did. Like, what have you done for me lately?
Right.
I think we've said before. And it's just, yeah, he was being overshadowed by his other triumvirs. All of these guys must have had massive egos. And both, you know, Caesar and Pompey are both wealthy in their own right. So what does Crassus bring to the triumvirate? Like, he might have been worried all along the way, well, do they still need me? Am I still...
Right.
What happens if they kick me out of the deal? They don't need me anymore because I don't have the glory, I don't have the power, people aren't talking about me in the streets, I don't have the followers.
Sure.
Now, so Parthia is the northeastern area of modern Iran. People are wondering mm-hmm. where Parthia fits into it.
Way over there.
So he decides he's going to go and conquer Parthia, and there was absolutely no good reason for like, they weren't attacking Rome. They weren't, like Britain was, according to Caesar, supporting Rome's enemies.
Right.
There was no justification for this other than I need to take a scalp. It's for my reputation.
Yeah.
And I'm bored. I'm in my early 60s. I want people to give me a triumph. Where's my bloody triumph?
Exactly. And the other side of that is, as long as he's part of the triumvirate and he can get what he wants, he has Imperium and he has an army. And let's not anybody delude ourselves. In order to really protect yourself, it's really good if you have 20,000 men standing behind you with swords who swore loyalty to you. So, I mean, this guy's been consul twice. He's got money, he's got power, he's got influence, but he's still being outshined by these much brighter stars. And so he's going to be the governor of Syria. He's going to stay in Syria for most of 54 BC and raise funds for his invasion, i.e. taxes. And he's just gearing up, getting ready to go because he is going to have his moment on the stage. Even though, like you said, he's in his 60s, but he is going to have his moment. He's got his plans and he's heading out and he's getting ready to go.
And we have to remember that none of these guys, the triumvirs, really like each other, particularly Crassus and Pompey. Had never really been friends. They were the real frenemies. They'd been co-consuls twice, but they kind of hated each other. They had a lot of enmity towards each other. They were major rivals. And I just keep thinking that these three guys must have been looking at each other with fish eyes, you know?
Yeah.
They were all waiting for the other one to screw, the other two to screw them over, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And again, we've got to remember the context of what had been going on in the Republic for the last 50, 60 years. We've had a series of dictatorships. We've had all sorts of civil war, all sorts of problems.
Yeah.
I'm sure Caesar's not the only guy at this point who's thinking, this would all be so much easier if I was just dictator and I didn't have to deal with all these idiots.
Yeah, play the games. Yeah,
yeah. So I'm sure Crassus is thinking that. I'm sure Pompey is thinking that. I'm sure all of them, to some degree, are thinking also, I wish I could get rid of these two idiots.
Right.
Like, I wish I didn't need these guys.
Because, but I do.
Well, it's, if you've ever been in a band or in a business partnership or in a marriage or in any sort of thing where you have to work with two other people.
Right.
It takes, there's a lot of give and take. There's a lot of, all right, I'll listen to your idea. Your ideas are shit, but I'll sit down and I'll listen because.
And I'll smile. And,
yeah. Well,
Ringo, like doing right now.
Ringo, you've got an idea for a song, Ringo. Right. Well, of course, Ringo.
Let's hear it.
It's a democracy. We'll hear that's your right. idea for a song, Ringo. Oh, a yellow submarine. That sounds great, Ringo. If we, listen, Ringo, if we do the yellow submarine song.
Will you shut?
Can we just say that that's your song for this
that's
album?
That's right.
Okay, I tell you what. We'll make a movie out of it.
There we go.
And then that's your contribution. Then you can, yeah.
Yeah, drummers cause so much trouble, which makes this next point so much more interesting. You got Caesar who cannot go into Rome, and now Pompey, even though he's not in the two Spains, he's just outside the Pomerium. He can't go into Rome, and now Crassus is gone. So the three most powerful men are not in the city that runs this republic. And so other people start to rise because you can only do so much if you're not there in person. Yeah, everybody's got agents, but it's not the same thing. And now finally, after years, others are starting to come up, but they're going to feel the influence of these three men, even though they're not in Rome.
Well, one of the other consequences of the triumvirs not being in Rome was nothing could get done.
Exactly.
People were complaining about the fact that they couldn't make decisions because even the consuls or the tribunes, they had to basically write a letter for permission to one of the triumvirs to get stuff done. Even raising armies, the triumvirs between the three of them had something like over 20 legions, which was the majority of the Roman army. At the time, so there were no other governorships. People couldn't do anything. So we have, at this time, the consuls, Lucius Domitius Ahenobarbus.
Who swore he would win, who swore he would be back, and now he is. Good on you.
Yeah, good on you, Ahenobarbus.
And who's his partner? I love this part. Who's his consular colleague?
Clodius's eldest brother, Appius Claudius Pulcher.
Yeah, he's got to be semi as crazy as his brother.
Yeah. And I don't know what Clodius is doing at this time. 54, but he was still involved in something. I don't think he was still a tribune at this stage, but he's still running around being crazy.
Oh, yeah.
Causing trouble.
He's got influence. Yeah, exactly. He's causing trouble in the streets. Not as much as he was, but he's still there.
And these two consuls are complaining, look, we can't even appoint people to the junior ranks.
Right.
Because there's just we can't make decisions by ourselves. We may be consuls, but everyone knows we're puppet consuls.
In name only. Yeah. Exactly. Exactly.
So Rome was basically kind of at a standstill while the three guys that ran it were off doing stuff. Although we talked about up until this stage, Pompey wasn't in Rome, but he was in one of his estates just outside of Rome, I'm guessing. He hadn't gone to Spain. He was he was hanging close to Rome, but couldn't go across the Pomerium, I guess.
He was still doing the grain. He was still in charge of the grain. I forgot about that.
But he wasn't even doing that. I mean,
no, he's not doing it. But his name is on the on the seal or whatever. But no, he's not doing shit. But
he's delegating.
He's delegating the hell out of everything. Yes. I hope to do that one day. But that was his excuse.
You delegate all of the production to me, dude. I edit, I do it.
That makes me brilliant. But yeah, but that was his excuse to say, that's right. That was his excuse to say that close to Rome. Yeah, I got a bunch of grain.
Yeah, I
got to
look after the grain, yeah.
That's right. You need me here. But anyway, back to Caesar. So he comes back to Britain. He comes back from Britain and he has another council, which never really seems to solve any problems. So he calls all the Gaulish tribes together. Turns out it was a really bad harvest. There's not enough food to go around. And so he can't keep all of his legions in one area because there's no food around. And I'm kind of disappointed in Caesar about this. He could have said, well, my men are staying with me. We're staying together for protection, and you will bring grain, corn, whatever. So, but no, he doesn't do that. He scatters his men out. And I just can't help but think that's, I don't know if that's overconfidence or whatever, but turns out to be not his best move.
Yeah. So again, the Gaulish tribes, the Gallic tribes are not happy. They haven't learnt. And you got to hand it to the Gauls, really. Caesar's been there for 4 or 5 years now, just kicking ass and taking names. Tribe after tribe after tribe gets defeated, and yet they keep picking themselves back up and going, "All right, we're going to take one more crack at getting the Romans out of our lands." They were freedom fighters. They weren't. Yep. They weren't going to give in to the imperial invaders. So I have a huge amount of respect for the French at this stage. Always love the French. These were the original French. What were they in World War II? The resistance, the résistance.
Mm-hmm.
The Gallic résistance. They were smoking smelly little cigarettes and hiding in shadows with their collars turned up,
causing trouble whenever they could.
So people may remember before Caesar's second trip to Britain, we talked about before he could go, there was a bit of an internal dispute in the Treveri, like rival leaders, a bit of internal warfare. The guy that won that with the support of Caesar, his enemy was Indutio Marus.
Okay, so Indutio Marus was the guy that Caesar decided against. He put someone else in charge. But while Caesar's gone, they had killed the man that Caesar selected. So Caesar's got to be coming back. And that's got to be his first red flag to go, huh, the guy I chose is now got a sword in his gut. And Indutio Martis, the guy I did not want, is still around causing trouble. Now, he and Caesar on paper made peace. I'm sure they did their secret handshake. He gave over some hostages. But while Caesar's gone and when winter comes, he is biding his time. He's talking to the other tribes. He's trying to stir up some trouble. And he does control a certain number of the Treveri troops. And they are with him. And he's got a plan to finally strike back at Caesar, whether it's personal or whatever. But he's finally got a plan. They're gonna take advantage of Caesar scattering out his forces for the winter.
And not just him, but there's also some other tribes that are getting behind him, whether it's coordinated or just spontaneous attacks happening. But the Eburones, who live in the Ardennes, which is this forest sort of around Luxembourg, Belgium, modern part of the world. And so they have a couple of war leaders, Ambiorix and Catavolcus. Catuvolcus, Ambiorix.
I thought it was interesting that the Treveri were doing the talk, but they're not the ones who end up striking first. It is the, how do you say that again?
Eburones.
Who are like a part German, part Belgic people, and they're in the Ardennes, and they elect their two war leaders, and they're going to go after the Romans that are near them first before the Treveri could act.
Yeah, so there's a variety of uprisings across Gaul. As you said, Caesar's spread his troops out into winter quarters, and they're easier to pick off and attack, these little sort of skirmish attacks.
Absolutely. But you have to admire Ambiorix, or however you say Ambiorix. I'm not sure how to say his name. Ambiorix, I think. But his plan is freaking brilliant. So so he's one of the two war leaders. They go to the camp where the 14th Legion is at. There's 15 cohorts. That's the 14th Legion and five other cohorts from another Legion. So they literally have the surprise attack on these guys. I mean, there's about 6,000 to 8,000 Romans in this camp, and out of nowhere they're attacked. But because it's a Roman camp, Roman built and Roman manned, they're able to beat off this attack. And it was just so brilliant. The two Roman people inside, the leaders, the legates, Cotta and Sabinus, are able to organize their defenses and beat back this attack. But that was really just a ploy for Ambiorix. He has this beautiful tale to tell them as the sun comes up when his first attack doesn't work.
Yeah. Now there's the fact that this camp seems to be commanded by two guys, Cotta and Sabinus, as you say,
yeah,
is part of the problem of what happens next, according mm-hmm. to many historians. If Caesar had put one guy in command, one guy would be able to make a decision about what to do next. But because there are two guys who don't agree with the plan of action when they're getting attacked, everything starts to fall apart.
Yeah. So if I can, Ambiorix, he attacks. It doesn't work. The sun comes up and he goes, look, Parley, he comes up and he goes, look, I didn't want to fight. My people made me. And to be honest with you, there's a huge conspiracy going around the entire area of Gaul, and everybody's attacking all the troops. Now, because Caesar's been good to me, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to let you guys go out alive, and you can go and join the next Roman camp. I think it's about 50 miles away, and you can go and you can help them. I'll let you go, and I'll just tell my people I tried to stop you. But it didn't work, and I'm doing this favor for you because Caesar was so good to me. Turns out to be a huge load of horse crap. But anyway, so the two legates argue throughout the night, and they can't decide what to do. But in the end, they do take him up. They do take Ambiorix up on his offer, and then next day they march out of the camp, a perfectly good, supplied, safe, you know, relatively safe camp, and they march out of it, heading towards, I believe, Labienus's camp, which is about 50 miles away. So his ploy worked brilliantly.
And so we got Sabinus and Cotta. Sabinus wanted to accept the offer. Mm-hmm. Cotta said, and this is according to Caesar based on stories right. he was told later, Cotta said, no, we should stay here. We should defend the camp. We should be good Roman soldiers.
Right.
Caesar said, you know, hold the fort. We're going to hold the fort. Sabinus was like, we can't hold the fort. We've got to move. You know, we're being attacked. They're offering us safe travel. how stupid is this guy, really? You need somebody, you know, on the wings going, it's a trap. Watch out, it's a trap. I mean, seriously.
He should have pulled his sword out and said, you're too stupid to live.
Yeah.
But that's my, yeah.
Yeah.
Because I'm not dying for you.
Yeah. Yeah. So for whatever reason, Sabinus wins the debate. They start marching. They get surprised. They get ambushed by the Eburones as they're passing through a ravine. The Romans were surrounded. They couldn't escape. They couldn't defend themselves. They get whittled down. Cotta gets hit in the mouth by a stone flung from a slingshot. His teeth are smashed. His jaw's broken. Blood everywhere. But he's still alive. He's still saying, keep fighting, keep fighting.
And he's probably still cussing Sabinus. But anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sabinus is still trying to negotiate with Ambiorix. He's like,
come on, no.
I'm not quite sure what's going on here. We need to sit down.
Hello?
Yeah. I miss a part of the plan here? At which point did you say we were going to be ambushed? I think there's been some failure to communicate.
Yeah, that's what on a massive, massive personal scale. He and his bodyguard are overrun and slaughtered on the spot.
Cotta keeps trying to organize the guys into resistance, but he finally gets killed as well. There's a handful of survivors that manage to get to the camp of Labienus, our friend, finally get there. But basically 15 cohorts, as you say, I think it was about 500 men to a cohort, 480 soldiers officially plus some hangers-on. So 6,000 to 8,000 Roman soldiers,
gone.
Sort of two legions basically wiped out in one hit. Which, in terms of Caesar's career, this is one of very few defeats that his troops ever encounter. So this is a big blow for Caesar. But of course, he doesn't know that this has happened right now. He won't know about this for actually quite some time because he's not there.
Right. If I can ask a question, and I would really like to hear from our listeners on this, because this is a question that applies to almost every military defeat. Who's to blame? Is it Cotta and Sabinus, or is it Caesar? Because one, he's ultimately in charge. Two, he made the decision to put these two men in charge as opposed to one man in charge. Because Sulla had the same problem with Marius when he helped in the war against Jugurtha. I don't know if there's one definitive answer, but who is ultimately whose fault is this? Is it the two legates on the scene, or is it the commander who is in charge, but he's way far away and he had nothing to do with this particular decision? What's your take on that, Cam? If you have that one, you know.
Yeah.
That's a tough one.
I kind of understand Caesar having to spread his guys out, as you say, for a couple of reasons. He thought, wrongly as it turns out, that Gaul had been Pax Romanid.
Right.
And they'd been there for quite a while now, so there was problems being able to get supply chains set up for all of his legions. He's been growing the army too significantly.
Sure.
Plus he's got prisoners and, you know, hostages, all this kind of stuff. So spreading them out, probably thinks that what's left of the Gallic tribes, a couple of legions of Roman soldiers, should be able to handle.
Should be.
Yeah. So I can understand him spreading them out. I don't understand why he had two guys with equal command. That seems hard to fathom for exactly this reason. But maybe he just thought, I mean, you have two consuls in power at any one time, and these guys were sort of junior consuls under him, I guess. Maybe he thought they should just, you divvy up the work, right? You do a week on, week off, month on, month off, something like that in terms
of
running the camp.
Yeah, but, stupid and smart, yeah, but yeah.
But, of course, when a crisis hits and they get attacked, they've got equal power. Although it should have been, I mean, if they were divvying up, it should have been, well, whoever's week it is, whoever's on this week.
Right. Should have, yeah.
Is the guy that gets to make the call. Anyway.
Yeah.
It's a disaster. And Caesar, in his commentaries, places all of the blame on Sabinus. Way, and of course, everything we know about this, we know from Caesar. Right. So Caesar portrays Cotta as having the sensible arguments, hey, we should stay and fight. We're Roman soldiers. That's what we do. Caesar expects us to be here. Exactly. Sabinus, he's very, very critical of. Neither of these guys had very influential families back in Rome, so he didn't worry about upsetting anyone. But he distances himself from the blame. He, at no point in the commentaries does he say, but yeah, I'm the boss, and so the buck stops here, which is interesting for Caesar, because based on what I know of him at this stage, I would expect him to accept full responsibility for the defeat. He doesn't, because he must know that this is not going to play well in
There's
Rome.
No way to spin this. Yeah.
The great damage Caesar control. Screwed up. Yeah.
So I thought it was interesting that the Eburones, even though they had this great victory, they almost screwed, well, to a degree, they screwed up by reverting to form. Instead of staying cohesive and going on to the next camp, they pretty much take all the Roman booty they can get, and they start heading home to their different villages, and they start spreading the word of the victory. So in one way, this is good for them because they've had this victory and they've got something out of it. But now you got to think word is going to get back to the Romans because they didn't keep their mouth shut and they didn't just keep moving on to the next camp, you know, like dominoes. So they kind of screw themselves after this very impressive victory against the Romans.
But maybe they're thinking, well, we've proven that the Romans can be defeated, spread the word, everyone else will rise up and attack local legions. I just want to mention, I've got something from CZ. I'll just read from the commentaries because I want to talk about the Eagle Bearer. Caesar writes, Sabinus orders those tribunes of the soldiers whom he had at the time around him and the centurions of the first ranks to follow him. And when he'd approached near to Ambiorix, being ordered to throw down his arms, he obeys the order and commands his men to do the same. In the meantime, while they treat upon the terms and a longer debate than necessary is designedly entered into by Ambiorix, being surrounded by degrees, he is slain. Then they, according to their custom, shout out victory and raise their war cry, and making an attack on our men, break their ranks. There El Cotta, while fighting, is slain, together with the greater part of the soldiers. The rest betake themselves to the camp from which they had marched forth, and one of them, El Patricidius, the standard bearer, when he was overpowered by the great number of the enemy, threw the eagle within the entrenchments and is himself slain while fighting with the greatest courage before the camp. They with difficulty sustain the attack till night, despairing of safety. They all to a man destroy themselves in the night. They destroy themselves. Yeah. So they, ritual suicide.
Yeah.
A few escaping from the battle, who apparently didn't like the whole ritual suicide idea.
No, that'd be me. That's not for me.
I would. Trust me.
I would.
But I think I left the gas on back home. Right. And I've
What's
just,
behind curtain number two, Johnny?
I tell you, I'm just gonna pop over here. Check. Yeah. You start without me. Don't wait for me.
Go ahead.
I will come.
I'll be the big finish. I'll be right back.
I wonder how these guys were perceived on one hand, they didn't do the honorable thing. They left themselves open to being captured and tortured for information. But on the other hand, if it wasn't for them getting to Labienus, Caesar wouldn't know about this. He wouldn't know what happened. He wouldn't know the story. I'm fascinated to know what happened to these guys afterwards. Were they executed for being cowards and running away? Were they rewarded for being brave enough to sneak through enemy lines and get information to Caesar? We don't know. But I like that story about Patricidius, who threw his standard, his eagle, into the trenchments before he was killed. I mean, you have to assume that they got it anyway.
They got it. Yeah. They stepped over his dead body and got it anyway. But for a moment, it was, you shall not have this.
And you won't take it from me.
That's right.
You can kill me, but you will not take my standard from me anyway. You can take it from, you can pick it up over there, but you're not taking it from me.
I don't know what Latin is for damn right, but whatever. Yeah.
I mean, whether or not that actually happened and Caesar's
It's good press.
Caesar's just trying to build a good story about, wow, look at how brave and noble some of my soldiers are, not Sabinus so much. But interesting again that these stories are peppered throughout the commentaries. Remember the guy that jumped off the boat on the first excursion to Britain? There's another standard bearer. He peppers his commentaries with these little guys doing heroic things.
Right. You got to think that just gets eaten up back at Rome. You got to. They're like, the women are holding their breasts. Oh, that's so amazing. I don't know. I'm making this up. They're holding something. I don't know what they're holding. But anyway.
They're videoing themselves holding it and watching it back later and getting turned on. Hey,
you promised you wouldn't talk about that. No, you didn't promise. I need you to promise. Don't talk about that. Anyway, so the word starts getting around and the nervi hear about this and they're like, hell yeah, or whatever the nervi is for that. And so they attack the camp of Quintus Cicero. Like that,
sorry, random soundbite.
No, I'm sure. I'm sure it wasn't planned. So again, you have to give some marks to the Romans. The attack on his camp, Quintus Cicero's camp, is totally taken by surprise. They had no idea what's coming, and they're able to beat off the first attack. And so then I think that the Nervi with some of the Atuatuchi, as well as some of the Iburnerone, how do you say that? Iburnerones?
Yeah.
I can't think. Yeah, so they attack, but I can't believe what the Romans did in the middle of the night after beating off the first attack. Just amazing engineering feat.
Yes, but before we do that, I just want to get back. I'm finished with the attack on Sabinus and Cotta. That's all right. I just want to point out that Napoleon himself later said that it's better to have one bad commander than two good ones with shared authority.
That's so true.
Yeah.
So true, yeah.
That's what I think about with this show, Ray.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wait, what? Anyway.
That's why.
I'm going to think that one through, and I'll get back to you on it, okay?
And we should also point out, when we're talking about the impact of all of this, that the Eburones were one of the less prestigious tribes in all of Gaul. This is why we haven't heard of them before.
Right.
It wasn't the Treveri or the Nervi or any of these guys we've talked about before. These were nobodies. This was like... let's say an American military base being surprise defeated by the Australian
army. I was wondering who's it going to offend.
Oh well, let's face it, Australia's military is a joke.
So boom, out of nowhere these guys come up and they're like, we're number one, because they did something that nobody else to this moment had been able to do.
Yeah, and the Romans at this up until this point were invincible, undefeated, and all of a sudden these nobodies sneak up on them, kick the shit out of them. Must have sent shockwaves through both the Romans
absolutely
and the Gallic tribes when they found out about it. Like, shit, this is doable, we can do this, guys.
This is doable. That's right.
So yes, so you're talking about Quintus Cicero.
Yeah. Yeah, he I used to think maybe I didn't have the right take on him, but it turns out that he wasn't the exact opposite of Cicero. He wasn't a true military man. He did his job, he did it well, but he was writing letters to his big brother, Cicero, about all the different writings. I don't know if it was poetry or stanzas or I can't remember whatever, but he was getting a lot of writing done during his time in Gaul. And so I don't think he was a true military man, but when the moment came, he did what he had to do, kind of like Cotta, and he stood up and he organized the defense and he kept his men fighting and awake throughout the night. And he really does shine in this moment, even though he's probably not another Caesar. But he does a very impressive job.
I thought it was his big brother, Marcus, that was writing the poetry to him.
Right, but he was doing something that was – I can't remember. He was doing something not soldierly – like sharpening his sword 24 hours a day or marching really? All the time, you know, that kind of stuff.
Well, he was a Cicero. I mean,
he
come from a rich nouveau family, very well educated, like his big brother, you know, very well educated in the classics and the Greeks and the blah 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 blah, probably.
Yeah,
but
I never appreciated that basically his job was, you know, Caesar needed to be nice to Cicero, so he gives his little brother a job.
Yeah.
Cicero doesn't really want to be there. I mean, it's muck and it's mud and, you know, all that stuff. He'd rather be in Rome, but he does a good job because that's his role to play in between the relationship between these two more powerful men.
So after his camp gets attacked, he has his guys build 120 turrets to strengthen the ramparts of the camp.
Wow.
They already had the wood for it. They were going to use it to build new things for the camp. So,
In one night.
So they hadn't really put the fortifications in place when they were attacked. So they start building this stuff crazy. There's another attack the following day. Cicero says, hey, let's fight. He doesn't give in like Sabinus does. He rallies his troops, supervising them as they build the defenses and the fortifications all through the night. He wasn't a very well man. He was probably a little bit sickly. We don't know what was wrong with him, but
something was.
Yeah, he had to take a break eventually, but he did a good job from what we can tell. But again, we have to remember that Caesar's probably making him look good in his commentaries because of the relationship he wants to have with the elder Cicero. Right. So he's portrayed favorably, whether or not he was really the man that made it all happen, we don't know. But at least he didn't give in and cave like Sabinus did.
Yeah. So even though they're holding off, their camp is taking damage. They are losing some men. And since this had been going on, since the very first attack, Cicero had been, Quintus had been smart enough to try and send men out to get out of there to spread the word. And these men keep getting captured. They're brought back to the camp and tortured and killed right in front of the camp walls for the Roman soldiers to see. But eventually, I think, what is it, like a week or something like that before one of his men actually get through the lines and they're able to spread the word.
Now, Caesar claims at this stage in the commentaries that the Nervi that were attacking Cicero had 60,000 men.
Right.
But a couple of commentary books ago,
literally,
in 57 BCE, he said, "This battle being ended, the nation and name of the Nervi being almost reduced to annihilation, their old men, whom together with the boys and women we have stated to have been collected together in the fenny places and marshes, on this battle having been reported to them since they were convinced that nothing was an obstacle to the conquerors and nothing safe to the conquered, sent ambassadors to Caesar by the consent of all who remain and surrendered themselves to him, and in recounting the calamity of their state, said that their senators were reduced from 600 to 3, that from 60,000 men they were reduced to scarcely 500 who could bear arms." Now he's saying they have 60,000 men again. So either they've been really busy, or one of his stories is not really cogent. And the fact that he's forgotten that is
convenient.
Well, disconcerting, and I guess...
Absolutely, But you got to think, as much as he's been slaughtering people left and right, and let's, you know, whenever I see numbers back from this time period, I have a tendency to cut them in half. Still, we know he's killed a lot of men. He's enslaved a lot of women and children, but it just shows you how many people there are in this area that are still left to cause him a lot of trouble and his men.
Yeah.
Now... If I could real quick, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting that the man who finally gets through to give Caesar the warning is not a brave Roman soldier. It's a Gaul slave from a Gallic nobleman. Now that's just loyalty. I want you to run through these lines. You're probably going to be captured and tortured and killed right in front of us. But I want you to run through these lines and go find Caesar's camp and tell him. And this guy's like, "Yes, sir," but he does make it. Just be good to your slaves, people. You never know when you're going to need them, okay? That's just my word.
And that's a fascinating story. As you say, he was the slave of a Gallic nobleman, but was working with Cicero now. So I wonder if he'd somehow been transferred, his ownership had been transferred from the Gallic nobleman to Cicero, and he was treated better by the Romans than he had been by his Gallic masters, and just decided that's where his loyalties should lay with the Romans. But he does, he runs off and manages to get news to Caesar, not only about the fact that Cicero's under attack, but that Sabinus and Cotta's legions had been destroyed. There was but one Sabinus in the Roman army, Cicero apparently said. Like, not me. I'm not going to cave in.
Right.
Some interesting stuff about the Gauls at this stage that I've got. They had been learning. So remember when the Romans first turn up in Gaul, the Gauls had never seen anything like this before. They were like, holy shit, this is
siege what? Equipment? What is that?
Remember, I think it was it the Nerve? I can't remember who was laughing at them when they were building siege towers.
That's right. And then they lifted it up and they're like, oh, I get it now.
Yeah.
Oh, crappy doodle. Yeah.
Yeah, but they had been learning. So they, when they've got Cicero's camp surrounded, they're making a bank and a ditch.
All the way around it.
Yeah, and they've got no tools to do this, so they're using their swords to dig the trench, to cut down trees.
That's just badass.
But there's so many of them. Yeah, they get this whole thing done in 3 hours. They completely surround Cicero's camp. They've got the Romans pinned in. They can't get out. So then they're slinging red-hot balls and darts of lighted straw over the Roman ramparts, trying to set the camp on fire. The wind is fairly high on this particular day. The fire's spreading. They're trying to burn the Romans out. They're using Roman tactics against the Romans. You got to give the Gauls credit here. They're not only ballsy, but they're learning. They're adapting. It's terrific stuff.
Yeah, they're balls with brains. Sorry, I'm sorry. So. The camp that Caesar's at, Samarobriva, how do you say that?
Samarobriva, yeah.
Yeah, which is really, I think, as far as we can tell, the best we can tell, modern-day Amiens. So the word gets to him late evening, and he's like, okay, my 14th legion has been destroyed. Another legion has been destroyed, and now Quintus is under attack. It's time for Caesar to kick it into high gear, but he's only got one legion with them, and they've got the baggage train. They've got all the records. They've got all the pay. They've got all the grain. They've got hundreds of hostages. He can't just drop all that and take off. He's got to wait till he can get some more men to cover all the stuff, so then he can take off. So as much as Caesar's itching to dash and save Quintus, he has to wait, I guess, another day until Marcus Crassus' son can come take over, you know, guarding all the stuff, and then, only then, can he take off.
And this has got to be pretty tense time for him. If Cicero's camp gets destroyed as well, it's just going to further encourage the rest of Gaul to attack Roman. So after 4 or 5 years of success after success after success, he's become wealthy, he's become famous, he's had triumph after triumph, he's gone to Britain. All of a sudden, he can see it crumbling. A lifetime of work.
Could
disappear in the matter of days or weeks if he doesn't sort this out. His entire life, never have ever heard of Julius Caesar if he didn't get this next couple of weeks right. Yeah.
Or all they claim that he has could be the exact opposite. He could went down in one of the worst generals in Roman history. So his name may have lived on, but in the exact opposite fashion.
Now, one of the things that he does at this stage that I love is he stands up in front of the troops that he's got.
Mm-hmm.
He takes his razor and he snaps it in half, throws it behind him, and he says, I am not going to shave until I have avenged Sabinus and Cotta and their troops. Well, fuck Sabinus, just Cotta.
Call it like you see it.
Yeah. Now he says to these guys, I'm not going to shave. I will not shave again.
Right.
Until I have righted the situation, till I've avenged our fallen comrades. Now, people may recall back from the early episodes, Caesar was a bit of a Nancy. Mm. He was renowned for his appearance. He was always well...
Fastidiousness.
Yes.
Yes.
Cleanliness is next to...
Romanus.
Apolloness, Venusness. Yeah.
Zeusness.
He was descended from Venus.
Venus, Venusness, yeah. And so it really is a big deal. I mean, no, even in Britain, he was shaving. That was just what you did as a Roman a senator, whatever. So it might not sound like a big deal, but it's in that time, in that culture, it is a very big deal, and it's a very good declaration that he's making. It's very visceral. It's visible. The men can see it. And so it's got to impress them more than what we think it would.
I'm fascinated by this. Like, I'm sure Caesar knew what he was doing. It was a very simple, but obviously he believed it would connect emotionally with his troops. This must have been a huge... Like, he's not, I'm not going to eat, or I'm not going to have sex again, or I'm not going to...
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm not going to bathe. I'm not going to do something until we've avenged your troops. I'm not going to shave. As you say, they could see it. It was visible. And you'd also be able to tell when he felt like the job was done because he'd be clean-shaven again.
Exactly.
But just it's, I don't know, I found that fascinating. I've spent a lot of time over the last couple of weeks thinking about that and the impact that that would have had on his troops, trying to understand what was going through Caesar's mind, what he thought this would convey to his troops.
Right. Well, I'll tell you what, I'm going to offer something up, and you can, and this is going to sound probably totally weird, and you can feel free to edit it, but this is the absolute gospel truth, I swear. After September 11th, my brother, the middle brother, Don, he was in the U.S. Army, and after September 11th comes, he was in his elite forces. I don't know anything about this. He and his men disappear. We don't hear from him for like weeks. And my the youngest brother, and I'm the oldest, we literally got together when we found out that Don had disappeared, because obviously they were going to go do something dangerous. And almost without saying all the words, we literally decided not to shave until Don came back. Now, I know that sounds totally crazy, and I'd never have done anything like that before, but it was almost instinctual. And we just did it, and we finished each other's sentence, and we did not shave until he came back. So I think there's just something hardwired into males or whatever. But when I read that, I was like, oh, God, that kind of creeped me out, you know, because it reminded me of September 11th and my brother disappearing and being worried for weeks and months. So I think there is something really to that, that I can in no way define or put words to.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, you've still got a beard, so.
Yeah. Well, this was a long time ago. I've shaved several times and had a beard, so, but for, at that time we just you know.
That's it. That's fascinating. That's great.
Yeah, and I cannot. And it's not like it was planned. It's not like I walked up to him and said, "Hey, we're going to do this." We were just talking one day and kind of consoling each other, and it just happened. We just decided to do it. We didn't even talk about it. We just agreed to do it. So there's something to it, but I don't know what.
I personally never shave until I have a meeting with a client, and then I have to shave.
Yeah. There you go.
Once a week. Yeah.
There you go. But if you think about it for a second, on a slightly lighter note, Caesar's mother is dead. His daughter is dead. He's worried about what Pompey's going to do. He's got all this tension. He comes back. He's lost a legion. He's about to lose another legion, maybe two. And now he actually gets a chance to vent, to let it all out. You think he's got to go over there, and he's just looking forward to killing as many people and to just swinging his sword as much as he possibly. This is his chance to let it all come out.
By the way, not only not shave, he wasn't going to cut his hair either.
Yeah.
So you can just imagine Caesar's hair's getting long, his beard's growing, he's starting to look like a wild man.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, I love this next line. So he sends the Gaul, the slave, back to Cicero. Dude, you know, you just risked your life. Well,
do it again.
I got some good news. I got some bad news.
Congratulations.
So you got to go back. Got to get a message back to Cicero saying we're coming. But we may not be there tomorrow, but we are coming. Hold out. Right. You know, Caesar is coming. The cavalry is coming. But he gets there, and Cicero's camp is surrounded. So how does he get the message into the camp? He writes it. Well, no, it's already written in Greek, I think. I don't think he wrote it in Greek, but it was written in Greek. And he ties it to a spear and throws it into Cicero's camp. Now, assuming apparently that if the Gallic tribes that were surrounding him, they were mostly Belgians, captured or got the message, they wouldn't be able to read the Greek.
Right.
So they wouldn't know that Caesar was coming. But the best part of the story is somehow he manages to throw the spear into the camp in the first place. I don't know how many attempts it took.
Right. How close did he have to get? Yeah.
But then no one notices it. Because there's 3,000 spears and rocks and the camp's on fire.
It's not a perfect plan. Not his best plan.
So apparently it's just sitting there for a couple of days.
Right.
Until somebody...
Like, oh, God.
Somebody goes, hey, What's that? What do you mean? Like, on that spear.
I tripped over a spear.
That spear, there's a note attached to it. What are you talking about? No, look.
Bob, is this your spear? Ted, Andy, is this yours?
Yeah. And so they, I just try and picture this going down. Oh, look, there's a bit of parchment attached to that spear. That's what, do you think the Belgians are sending us messages now?
That's right.
What's going on? So, I know, it's crazy. So somebody takes it to Cicero, and he goes, all right, everyone, gather around. Caesar's coming. And no sooner does he read this out than on the horizon they see smoke rising from the distance, which is the sign that a Roman forces is on its way, and they're setting fire to everything in their path. They're burning enemy farms and villages along the way, just to, I don't know, breed fear.
How's that for timing?
Yeah, so... but this whole idea, tying it to a spear, throwing it, and then it sits there for 2 days and no one notices it.
Right.
And then they do... It's hard for me to even start to get my head around how that happened.
Why not an arrow? You can shoot an arrow further than you could throw. Of course, it's smaller, but you could shoot an arrow further than you can throw a spear, I would think.
What if fun of it landed in a guy? Like, there's a Roman soldier. And he's like, there's a message.
Wasn't that on a Monty Python?
It had to be, anyway.
Message, sir. Okay, so, maybe I didn't think that through. But anyway, I'm glad the spear didn't hit anybody. I'm very happy about that.
Yeah. So, so Caesar now, I guess the Belgians, the Nervi, know that Caesar's coming. They can see the smoke as much as Cicero can, and they can put two and two together. They figure out what's going on.
Well, not only that, but it's not like Caesar's showing up with six legions. I mean, as from what I can tell, and I'm not sure if the other forces have joined him yet, I think he's got, one legion and like 400 cavalry or something like that. It's not like he's got this massive, overwhelming force that he can just push everybody away. Or had the other legions joined him by then?
No, I don't think he's got many guys at this stage. He just got straight there as quickly as he could. He didn't have time to wait for anyone. Just for Crassus to come and look after the records and the gold and the hostages, you know.
Right. So he's got his one legion, he's got his cavalry, not his normal guys that he can rely on. And Cicero is trapped, he's losing men left and right, the place is on fire. There's occasional spears raining down with notes on them in the middle of the camp. What the hell is Caesar going to do? That's a cliffhanger.
Find out next time, ladies and gentlemen.
And listen to the exit music. I love that.
Now we've got to do reviews and stuff.
Yes,
first,
yes.
You know. So that's... Saying, oh, right. Then. Yeah.
That's the show. Cut.
Cut.
All right. Cut. Whew. Okay.
Okay. Thanks to everybody who's been writing reviews and chatting with us on Facebook, sending us emails. It's been great. We're going to go back to giving away prizes for iTunes reviews. We haven't done it for a little while. I think we can do it again because that's fun.
Absolutely. Some of the most cleverest writing I've ever read have been in those reviews. So we just miss it too much.
We need to get back on that. Before we do that, I want to read out the names of the new patrons since the last show, because these people... putting some money in our PayPal account. They're enabling us to give away prizes.
Absolutely.
Pay for our hosting, cover the cost of all of that kind of stuff. So since our last episode, I think the following are our new patrons: Eric Bloom, Amanda Kipax, also the winner of the last competition on Facebook. Subodh Joshi, sorry if I pronounce any of your names wrong, but you'll deal with it. Jessica Robles, Andrew Pasco, g'day Andy, Annalise Alexander, Robert Wood, James Jeffries, James Phillips, and Joseph Strotman. They are our most recent patrons. So thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, for your continued support. Okay, onto some iTunes reviews, Ray. I'm not going to read all of them, and again, I'm not going to read the two negative reviews that have cropped up because we're not giving them any press anymore.
Yeah,
oh, exactly. but I'm going to try and pick. I'll read a couple of what I think the best ones are. You tell me which one you think is the best one.
All right.
I'm an American, a Christian, and a conservative. And I have learned that if you can't handle someone poking fun at or disagreeing with you on any of these subjects, you are taking your life much too seriously. I found Cameron on the Napoleon podcast first, then found Life of Caesar, and it's been a great trip so far. Sorry, Ray, I haven't gotten to your WW2 podcast yet, but know that you are next. I just today caught up with your latest, and as usual, the mix of banter and fact kept me engaged the entire time. Cameron, got to say, the Jay-Z remix was great. You had me laughing and replaying that section again and again, and I got my co-worker interested in this podcast as well. Keep up the good work. I look forward to listening to many more podcasts from you both, and not just on Caesar. Thank you, Tech429.
Yeah, Tech.
I want to do a shout-out, too, to Pat Pirtle, while I think of it. Pat Pirtle's been chatting with us on Facebook. Pat is another Republican Christian conservative and a judge in Seventh Court of Appeals judge in Amarillo, Texas, who said that he doesn't have a problem with some of my comments either. So listen, if you can have a Christian Republican judge from Texas,
oh my goodness,
and he doesn't get offended or upset, what's the problem the rest of you have?
Right. Let it go.
What else we got here? iPhone 5 TMO from the United States. This podcast is very enjoyable. It's growing on me. It's definitely unlike other history podcasts. Not a bad thing or a knock on the other podcast. The interaction between the two makes for an interactive and vivid illustration of the life of a particularly interesting figure in history. Keep it up, gents. Mm. For those complaining about Cam's anti-American banter, as you'd say, you're getting it all wrong. I don't even agree with him on a lot of it, but for Sulla's sake, it's a free podcast that forces no one Sulla point to listen. Furthermore, personal opinion and freedom of speech used to be valued in this country.
Yes.
Not only when you agree, but also when you don't. For those that want to supplement on the source material or want more, check out the premium cast. It's well worth the addition. So thank you, iPhone 5 TMO, whoever you may be.
Thank you.
Creation Boy from Canada says, I only discovered the podcast this morning and have already listened to quite a lot of episodes and did a review. A podcast of highly superior quality compared to the other ones of the type. Great contrast of history and comedy, which provides more than what you could ask for in interesting facts, key events, and cultural detail. That's a good effort, Creation Boy.
Yeah, yeah.
Philip G. White from Australia. Each time these two guys sit down and talk Life of Caesar, I love to sit outside with my glass of rum and settle down for the ride. The mix of great facts with humor makes this now my favorite podcast.
Oh.
He says, sorry, Ray, World War II. I don't know why he's apologizing, but he can't say all of your podcasts are his favorite podcasts. He's just got to pick one.
No, that's fine. I'm...
Now, I love this one. Blah, blah, blahs from Canada says, this is the first podcast series I ever listened to. And it sets the bar so high, it makes everything else I've tried to listen to sound like a sound that is really awful and annoying. The mix of humor and history is pure genius, and I certainly cannot get through a single episode without bursting out in laughter numerous times. The VIP series is a great addition, and I, for one, am glad that both Cameron and Ray have failed miserably in their goal to have it be more serious than the regular feed. Laughter makes everything better. That and bacon, of course. Keep up the good work, gentlemen. You're doing a fabulous job, and I'm looking forward to every episode you can squeeze out of this short period in history. P.S. Seeing as everyone loves a good stereotype, I was thinking Cameron could open or close every show by playing the didgeridoo. Just a thought. Well, blah, blah, blahs, I actually did take didgeridoo lessons.
Yes.
25 years ago, but could not get the circular breathing down, I'm sorry to say. It is bloody hard. Do you know what circular breathing is, Ray?
Is that where you keep blowing and you still have to breathe through your something? I'm not making this up as I go.
Yes, that's it. Yeah. So when they play a didgeridoo, they're doing the noise with their lips, but they have to keep breathing in through their nose and blowing out through their mouth at the same time. It's amazing. Wow. Really, really hard. Anyway, I love that review from Canada. Thank you, blah, blah, blahs.
Yeah.
I love this next one too. Nadia Nilo from the United States. I work at a boring job that gives me 9 hours of free listening time. And this is the first historical podcast I've downloaded. I've always loved ancient Rome, owning books such as Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, as well as the mammoth book of Eyewitness Ancient Rome and Ovid's The Metamorphoses. So Nadia Nilo is obviously, you know, she can read. I don't know why they have a boring job if they're that well-educated and able to read, but maybe that's just a choice.
Yeah.
So why not give this Life of Caesar podcast a try? I am not disappointed in the least. Ray and Cam make my day with their delightful banter and discussion on the subject. And though I was more interested in Rome altogether, I'm finding myself fascinated by Caesar. How can I be interested in ancient Rome and not Caesar? I don't know, but now I love him as I get to know him as a person. I have to say, I've only discovered this podcast a week ago, and it's now my favorite. I can't wait to listen to the next one and have joined the VIP cast as well. As Cam gets a lot of hate, I'm surprised because he's my absolute favorite. Suck on it, Ray. I adore his tangents as I learn even more about the basis of Rome and not just Caesar in general. I get a real feel of the life in ancient Roman time with his random trivia. As for Ray, well, he's nice and sweet too and does pull Cam back on track, which is almost disappointing but an evil necessity to say the least. All in all, I absolutely adore this podcast and the host and can't wait to purchase my favorite Caesar was a vampire and the infamous Pulla Sulla mug. Thanks for keeping a smile on my face during my tedious day, guys. Awesome, Nadia Nilo. I love you. Male or female, I'm equal opportunity with my
That's right.
Love.
True. With affection, yeah.
To people on iTunes anyway. Jerryox1 from the UK says it's worthy of a triumph. Life of Caesar is great. It's one of my favorite podcasts. It's full of wonderful storytelling, great banter and interesting asides. It makes history accessible and fun. That's surely a good thing. It's wonderful to hear two enthusiasts clearly having as much fun making the podcast as I do listening. We do a great job. Keep it going. Premium's good. Anyway, there you go. Lots of good stuff. Yeah. Just saying it's all good.
Yeah.
I'm looking for highlights here. I'm going to thank Donkey Mutt from Canada, Piers Review from Denmark. Something says haven't had so much fun since Caesar crucified the pirates. Okay,
that's two of us.
Those Danes, they're crazy. I like the review from Pop Up North in the UK that he's entitled "Up Your Labia Anus." Great show, gents. Makes the journey to work fly by. Really funny and insightful. Please keep from editing out any outtakes. Love those bits. I think that's got to be a new T-shirt. Up your labia anus. I like that one. Okay. Now, this is one of my favorite ones. I don't know if I read this last time. When did we do the last one? What date did we say it was?
The 12th.
Okay, no. So this is new. I thought this was new. This is awesome. From YLLAS. Maybe I did read this one. No. Okay. No, I couldn't have. Okay. It's from the 14th of September. Aussie abrasiveness plus southern charm equals perfect. This is from YLLAS Sally backwards, basically. Backwards Sally. This review is long overdue, but I've been waiting for the silly mug prizes phase to pass. Pony up, people. Buy one yourself. Well, Sally, we were going to offer you one.
That's right.
But she says it's silly, so I guess we don't give it to Sally. First of all, don't let Cameron's origin of evil stance, a.k.a. all roads lead to Washington, D.C., put you off. He's just overcompensating for giving in to his American wife's choice of names for their son, Fox. Hey, wow. I love the name Fox. Sure, a few people might think of David Duchovny in The X-Files or that it hints at a future sexy grrr manliness, but the majority will wonder, why would you want to associate the poor kid with the most virulent right-wing conservative pro-Christian mouthpiece of US media journalism, Fox News? Does Cam secretly admire Murdoch, its owner? Well, at least the poor kid got named before Cam discovered Fuck Knuckles. Actually, I do admire Rupert Murdoch in a way. I've met him. I met him once, had a conversation with him one night. Fascinating guy. I admire him purely from a, in the same way I admire a, I don't know, a Marius or a Sulla or a Caesar. Yeah. Like, what he has done in his life is amazing. I think, you know, a lot of what he does is, from the perspective of the general public, not great, but from his own perspective, hey, he's doing okay.
Yeah.
It's all about the Benjamins. All kidding aside, this podcast is a TARDIS. Oh, see, anyone who brings in Doctor Who trivia into this, you know that they've won shit. To quote Rose from Doctor Who, wow, it's much bigger on the inside than the outside. People like Ray who have never seen Doctor Who do not know what a TARDIS is or what that means, but
no.
Tough. But for Doctor Who fans, you get it. Cameron perfected his history as conversation style in his Napoleon series, and although I admire Ray's World War II series and Jamie Redfern's Arab Spring podcast, plug, listening to a conversation versus a monologue is far more entertaining and captivating, especially with an Aussie accent paired with Ray's southern US or shucks charm. Plus, by studying Caesar in ancient Rome, you're likely to get the jump on future plot lines on Game of Thrones, hanging along the Via Appia, tasting the golden elixir, etc. For those who criticize this series or think history is too serious or grave to laugh at, I'm in awe of your constitutions. I bet you're also puzzled by The Daily Show, poor dears. This is a friendly forum for disseminating what information has come down to us as, in quotes, history. The VIP pay-per-view parallel series, except we don't make you pay, you should pay, is perhaps more to your liking, and there are some exchanges with experts or scholars who push Ray and Cameron to entertain other viewpoints. As an example, Jamie Redfern challenged Cam's admiration of Caesar's use of third-person narration, pointing out as it was likely mere media manipulation, more objective if presented in the third person. Ah, Caesar, you clever devil, you. Whatever. Mm-hmm. It's a head-shaking romp and a good way to pass the time until the next season of Rake, the Aussie version, not that god-awful American attempt, is... Attempt, I'm not sure what that means. Sally! Rake's a great... Well, it's not. It's an okay TV show. About a naughty Australian lawyer who's just has a lot of sex and does a lot of drugs and gambles and, yeah.
How anyway. Spell it? R-A-K-E? Okay, never mind.
Yeah, look it up on Netflix if you've got Netflix.
All right.
Yeah,
gotcha. R-A-K.
Well, thank you, Sally. I love that.
Yes.
That was a huge effort.
Yes.
Got to pick a winner, Ray. We've got Nadia Nilo, who this is the first podcast ever downloaded, works in the boring job. We've got Sally. We've got Blah Blah Blah's first podcast series ever listened to. And what were the other highlights here? We've got iPhone 5 Timo.
Yeah, and Creation Boy.
Creation Boy. Great contrast of history and facts. I only discovered it this morning. I listened to quite a lot of episodes already. Yeah. And left a review. And then we've got Tech429, an American Christian conservative who says, you know.
Yes.
He liked the Jay-Z remix. but iPhone Type 5 Timo was the one who said that free speech used to be valued, whether you agree with it or not. I like that. So many good reviews and so many good points and clever and funny.
Absolutely. Oh. Yes.
So, up to you, dude.
I'm going to go with dramatic pause. iPhone 5.
iPhone 5 TMO. TMO. Too much something. Well, if you're listening to this iPhone 5 TMO, shoot us an email, arve@lifeofcaesar.com, with your details. Because the weird thing about this is it could be anybody. We don't know who it is. Anybody could send us an email and go, yeah,
that was
me.
Brilliant.
That was me.
I'm going to send an email.
Get the coffee mug. okay. And so thank you, though, everybody. That was terrific. Yeah. We appreciate that.
Absolutely.
Makes
it all worthwhile.
Coming up on the VIP show, guys, I just put out Dr. Arthur Kiviny, the guy who wrote the book on Sulla. In the next couple of weeks, we've got an interview with an Australian historian from La Trobe University. And we've also got Tom Holland, who wrote the excellent book Rubicon, who's on the show. I think we're recording him on the 12th, did I say?
12th, yes.
So that'll be out sometime in the next month. We've got a bunch of great interviews. Still no David Markham. Even if I told people on Facebook to send him emails and tell him to get off his ass, and he got on the group and went, rah, 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 rah. Still hasn't. I know, actually, he did go down to Cabo and got hit by a hurricane. So, like, okay, he's got that as an excuse.
Yeah, but, that's, yeah.
You know, but still.
Tell you what, he can do the summation after we finish the entire series on Caesar. How's that?
Yeah, maybe he can be our last guest.
There we go. We saved the best for last.
Yeah.
At least that's what we'll tell him.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, Ray.
Yes.
Hold on.
Yeah.
Hold on.
I'm holding it on.
I need that money, Raymond. Tikuno,
don't talk to me like that, Raymond.
Oh, there you go. There you go. I feel like I've been whipped. Sorry.
All right. That's it. Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye. Yeah.
The right button to turn off the recording, yeah?
Oh, yeah. There you go. Oh yeah, no, it's like watching a video of yourself playing with yourself and getting excited by it.
Playing with yourself?
I don't know.
Really?
I was trying to tone it down. I'm
wow.
Sorry. Master, but I can't say it.
Yeah.
I'm just joking.
We have teenagers who listen to the show, man.
Yeah, I won't say that. I hope this is not part of the show.
It's,
oh crap!
Of course, it's part of the show.
Oh shit!
Everything's part of the show.
My name is
I might have to
Dan.
Edit that part out now.
Yeah, yeah.
You're going to listen. Your mother-in-law is going to be listening to you talking about masturbating and watching video, not just masturbating, but videoing yourself masturbating and then watching it back and then getting turned
on. I want a disclaimer.
Getting turned on.
Okay.
When watching yourself.
Okay.
that's my blackmail reel right there. Man.
What would it take to not get that?
You don't even have enough.
How many coffee mugs would it take?